Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. I am genuinely excited today. We're about to embark on, well, an incredible historical and cultural exploration together. We're going to be looking at something truly ancient, Anna, the pre-modern Kurdish mother goddess of water and fertility. But what's amazing is how she's still sort of vibrantly alive. Our journey is going to trace her roots all the way from, you know, the ancient heartlands of Mesopotamia right up to how she appears in Kurdish folk religion today. Our mission here really is to unravel these layers of time and tradition. We want to help you grasp the incredible persistence of this figure, this powerful divine figure, and just how deeply she influenced Kurdish spiritual life. We'll try to connect the dots basically from those primordial goddesses right through to contemporary practices. You'll see how deep this spiritual lineage runs.
Exactly. And I think it's really crucial to understand right from the start that Anna isn't she's not an isolated phenomenon, not just some standalone deity that popped up. She's actually a remarkable regional crystallization of one of humanity's oldest, most fundamental religious traditions, the veneration of the divine feminine. The spiritual heritage is just vast. It flows, like you said, from the very wellsprings, the headwaters of civilization itself. So to really get Anna, we need to journey through Neolithic Anatolia first, then explore those complex pantheons in Mesopotamia. We'll need to delve into ancient Iranian traditions and look really closely at the indigenous highland cultures of Kurdistan too. It's about understanding not just who she is in the Kurdish context, but, well, how she came to be, how she built upon millennia of these foundational beliefs and sacred practices.
Okay, let's dive into that journey then. We're going way right back to the very dawn of settled human communities. Where did we first see these powerful female deities start to emerge? What's the earliest evidence we actually have for this reverence for a mother goddess figure?
That's precisely where we have to start, because goddess worship isn't some, you know, later add-on. It's truly foundational in the ancient Near East. Its origins go right back to the very beginning of settled life. The archaeology across Anatolia and Mesopotamia, it just shows this profound, continuous reverence for a female deity. And she's consistently associated with fertility, with birth, and often with dominion over the natural world. These really early cults established the basic archetypes, the patterns that would be inherited and adapted, elaborated on by the cultures that followed, including the Iranians and eventually the Kurds. The sheer age of this tradition is, well, it's staggering. To give you an idea, think about Derekli Cave. It's in Kahramanmaraş province in Turkey now. Archaeologists there unearthed a fired clay figurine, a mother goddess figurine, dated to an astonishing 16,000 years ago.
16,000? Wow.
Yes. It's one of the oldest artifacts like it in the whole region. It pushes goddess veneration deep into the upper Paleolithic. This is long before cities, long before empires. It really demonstrates powerfully that this reverence for the divine feminine was vital even in hunter-gatherer societies. It's a continuous thread right from the earliest spiritual expressions we can find. Then, moving forward in time, we see how this iconography really starts to take shape in the Neolithic period. A really famous example comes from Çatalhöyük, you know, the proto-city in central Anatolia, dating from about 7,000 to 6,000 BCE.
Right. Çatalhöyük. I've heard of the finds there.
Exactly. So there we find this baked clay sculpture. It depicts a corpulent female figure, incredibly powerful in her form. She's seated on a throne, flanked by two felines, maybe leopards or lions, and she's shown in the very act of giving birth.
That's such a powerful image.
It is, and this single image, it really codified several key attributes that would echo down through the ages. Her clear connection to fertility and procreation, obviously, her sovereign power, symbolized by that throne, and her role as Potniatheren.
Potniatheren, what does that mean?
It means mistress of animals. It shows her dominion over the natural world. And importantly, similar figurines from other Neolithic sites, like Hakalar and Göbekli Tepe, they confirm this wasn't just isolated to Çatalhöyük. It was a central feature of belief systems across Anatolia. These were agricultural societies, remember? So the life-giving power of the earth, reproduction, it naturally led them to place a female creative force right at the top of their cosmology. This early emphasis on a powerful female creator really lays the groundwork for everything that follows.
So we're talking about a belief system deeply embedded right from humanity's earliest settled communities. Mm. Okay. Now, as these scattered communities grow, become complex urban centers in Mesopotamia, how does this primordial mother goddess evolve? Does she get a formal name, a place in the official pantheon?
Precisely. That's the next stage. As civilization continues to coalesce, to grow in those river valleys of Mesopotamia, these primordial archetypes, they get formalized. They become part of these complex state-sponsored pantheons. And here, the preeminent female deity was the Sumerian goddess Inanna. Later, she was syncretized, basically merged with her Akkadian, Babylonian, and Assyrian counterpart, Ishtar.
Inanna Ishtar. Okay.
Yes, and Inanna Ishtar was arguably the most widely venerated deity in the entire Mesopotamian pantheon, maybe second only to the chief male gods, like An or Enlil. Her influence was truly vast, incredibly multifaceted. She was far more than just a simple fertility goddess, though that was definitely part of it. Her domains covered love, sensuality, procreation, yes, but also powerfully warfare, political power, and even the enforcement of divine law.
Wow, love and war, that seems contradictory.
Well, not necessarily to them. She was known by the impressive title Queen of Heaven. Her main cult center was the great Inanna Temple in Uruk.
Uruk, right, one of the oldest cities.
Exactly, one of the most ancient and really important centers. The complexity of her character, Inanna Ishtar's character, it really reflects the sophisticated worldview of Mesopotamian civilization. This pairing of seemingly opposite concepts, love and war, creation and destruction, they didn't necessarily see it as a contradiction. Think about it. In a world of competing city-states, survival depended on both agricultural bounty and military strength, so a goddess embodying both principles. She was seen as complete, as sovereign. She represented the totality of civilized life, really, with all its creative and, well, destructive potential. Her myths often show her as incredibly ambitious, dynamic, always striving to expand her power, like when she famously took over the Inanna Temple from the sky god An.
She took over his temple.
According to the myths, yes. Or when she acquired the Mins. These are like the divine decrees or essences governing all aspects of civilization from Enki, the god of wisdom. She basically tricked him out of them.
Huh. Sounds like quite a character.
Definitely. Her most prominent symbols were the lion.
Okay, that makes sense for war.
Right, representing her martial prowess, her ferocity, and the eight-pointed star symbolizing her identification with the planet Venus. And her worship wasn't just abstract theology. It was deeply integrated into daily life. We find mass production of clay figurines of her. They were likely used as household charms, maybe votive offerings in temples, or used in magical rituals to get her favor. And of course, her most famous myth, the story of her descent into the underworld to confront her sister, Ereshkigal.
Yes, the descent myth. That's a big one.
It is. It connects her powerfully to those universal themes of death and rebirth. It mirrors the agricultural cycle dormancy, growth, which was absolutely central to the fertility cults of the ancient world. So this intricate, powerful figure worshipped for millennia from Sumer to Assyria. She established a divine template. Her influence would just radiate across the Near East, profoundly shaping the goddesses who came after her. The key thing here is how this primordial force became formalized and multifunctional within a complex urban civilization.
That's remarkable. So Inanna Ishtar sets this incredibly powerful, multifaceted template for the divine feminine. Now, as we move eastward from Mesopotamia towards the Iranian sphere, how does this profound influence show up in the developing Iranian pantheon? Is there a direct successor, or does it evolve in a new way?
Well, as the center of political power shifted eastward, you know, with the rise of the Medes and then the Persians, that ancient Mesopotamian religious framework began to profoundly influence the Iranian pantheon that was developing. And the direct precursor to the Kurdish Ana is found in the Zoroastrian figure of Arvisura Anahita.
Arvisura Anahita, that's a mouthful.
It is, but she's a major goddess. Her name, her attributes, her cult, they all show a very clear synthesis, a blending of native Iranian traditions with those powerful Mesopotamian archetypes we just talked about. She really serves as the crucial link, connecting the ancient goddess of the Fertile Crescent to the folk beliefs of Kurdistan. Her full Avestan name, that's from the ancient language of the Zoroastrian scriptures, it's actually a descriptive title that tells you who she is. It's made of three adjectives, Arnuv, meaning damp or moist, Sura, meaning powerful or mighty, and Anahita, meaning pure or immaculate.
Ah, so mighty, moist, pure one, something like
that. Basically, yes. So her primary domain is clearly the waters, referred to as Oban. She's venerated as the personification of a mythical world river. This river is believed to flow from the highest heavens, and it dispenses life-giving waters to all the rivers and streams on Earth. It dispels dryness, ensures the health of all creation.
Okay, so definitely a water goddess at her core.
Absolutely, and her functions logically extend from that. She's a goddess of fertility, healing, and wisdom. The Zoroastrian hymns, the Yashts, describe her in great detail as a procreative deity. She purifies the seed of males, cleanses the wombs of females for conception, ensures safe childbirth, provides nourishing milk for mothers.
So she covers the whole reproductive cycle.
Exactly. A comprehensive protectress. And this role, as we'll see, was inherited directly by her Kurdish successor, Anna. Her main symbols were water itself, naturally, and the lotus flower, an ancient emblem of purity and creation. Now, her origin. It's been debated by scholars. There's evidence pointing toward a complex, syncretic evolution. Some have looked at an Indo-Iranian lineage, maybe linking her to the Vedic river goddess Sarasvati from India.
Interesting parallel.
It is, but the more widely accepted theory now posits that Anahita emerged from the fusion, the merging, of an indigenous Iranian water goddess with the powerful Mesopotamian goddess Ishtar.
Ah, so Ishtar's influence reaches Iran too.
Very much so. And this syncretism seems to have been quite deliberate, an act of religious and political policy, especially during the Achaemenid Empire. That's roughly 550 to 330 BCE. The Achaemenid kings, they wanted a cohesive religious framework for their huge multicultural empire. So they systematically aligned their own deities with the great gods of conquered Babylon, just like their supreme god Ahura Mazda was equated with Marduk, and the sun god Mithra with Shamash. Their great goddess Anahita was identified with Ishtar.
So it was strategic. Yeah. To bring the empire together.
It seems very likely. This process effectively upgraded Anahita. From what might have been a more regional nature deity, she became a major imperial goddess. And she took on attributes borrowed from Ishtar, her association with Venus, the planet Venus, and the title Banu, meaning the lady. These are Mesopotamian concepts, not really found in early Iranian religion. And the kings actively promoted her. Artaxerxes II, in particular, promoted her cult, even erected statues and temples to her in big imperial centers like Susa and Hamadan. Her worship spread throughout the empire. She became really prominent in Armenia, for example, where she was worshipped as Anahit, one of their top three deities.
Wow. So this syncretism was politically driven, but had huge religious consequences.
Precisely. It created this powerful composite deity who appealed to both Iranian and Semitic subjects. So the Anahita, who was passed down through the later Parthian and Sasanian eras, the one whose cult the Kurds encountered, she was already this rich blend of Indo-Iranian water veneration and Mesopotamian celestial and political power. The key insight here is how religious figures weren't just worshipped organically. Sometimes they were actively shaped by politics, by empire building.
That's truly fascinating. So Anahita is already this powerful composite imperial figure, a blend of ancient reverence and political strategy. But what about the specific region where the Kurds would eventually emerge, those northern highlands? Were there local goddesses there that had already prepared the ground, so to speak, for Anna? Did she find a ready, welcoming home in those traditions?
That's a crucial question. And the answer is yes, absolutely. The mountainous highlands, northern Mesopotamia, eastern Anatolia, the Zagros range the heartland of the Kurdish people. This area was definitely not a religious vacuum waiting to be filled. This region was home to ancient, sophisticated civilizations. Notably, the Hurrians, who were around from maybe 2500 to 1300 BCE, and later the kingdom of Urartu, about 860 to 590 BCE.
Hurrians and Urartians. Okay.
And both of these cultures had pantheons that featured powerful, prominent female deities. These indigenous goddesses formed a local religious substrate, a foundation, that predated the arrival of the Anahita cult. So they created a cultural environment that was already deeply receptive to the idea of venerating a great mother goddess. The Hurrians, whose influence spread across the northern Fertile Crescent, they worshipped several major goddesses. The most significant was probably Aushika, or Shashka. She was complex, very much like Ishtar, actually, embodying both love and war. She was considered the sister of the storm god Tirshib and known as the Queen of Nineveh. That title alone tells you how important she was.
Queen of Nineveh, yeah, that's significant.
And another central figure was Apat, or Hepet. She was Tirshib's wife. She started as the goddess of Halab, Aleppo, and rose to become the chief goddess of the whole Hurrian pantheon. Just the presence of these powerful female figures right at the core of their religion shows a cultural framework that recognized and venerated female divinity at the highest levels. Then you have the kingdom of Urartu, which flourished later in the Armenian highlands around Lake Van. They inherited and adapted many Hurrian traditions. Their pantheon was headed by a triad of male gods, Haldi, Tishiba, Shivini, but their consorts were also significant deities. The most important goddess was Arubani, wife of the supreme god Haldi. She was a goddess of arts and fertility. She's considered a probable predecessor, or maybe a regional equivalent, of the later Armenian Anahit.
Ah, so another potential link.
Exactly. And there were others, like Tushpua, the winged goddess of the capital city Tushba, and Huba, consort of the storm god Tishiba. So the existence of these well-established goddess cults right in the geographical and cultural mix where the Kurds emerged, it's critically important. It strongly suggests that the later embrace of Anahitana by the Kurds wasn't just them adopting a foreign belief, it was more like an assimilation. They took this powerful, compatible deity and brought her into a pre-existing cultural structure that already understood and valued a great goddess. The Iranian Anahita, with her water, fertility, power attributes, she would have found incredibly fertile ground there. Her cult likely merged with, absorbed the traditions of these older indigenous goddesses. And this process, assimilation rather than just replacement, helps explain why the mother goddess figure has had such profound, enduring resonance in Kurdish culture. The core insight, I think, is that Ana arrived not like a conqueror imposing something new, but more like a long-awaited guest, finding a ready home in a land already shaped by the divine feminine.
So if I'm getting this right, she's not just Anahita, she's Anahita who's already been sort of amplified by Mesopotamian power. And then she finds this really receptive ground in the Kurdish highlands because there were already powerful female deities there. It's like she's been gathering attributes and power for millennia, almost evolving and becoming more robust as she moved across these cultures and landscapes. Okay, let me try to quickly recap the journey so far. We've seen goddesses of fertility and power emerge from the very earliest settled communities. Then they get formalized into these complex, multifaceted deities like Inanna, Ishtar, and Mesopotamia. From there, they blend into the grand imperial figure of Anahita in the Iranian world. And finally, she finds this natural, welcoming home in the Hurrian and Urartian traditions of the Northern Highlands. What's really striking is how each step seemed to prepare the way for Ana, making her emergence feel almost inevitable, a culmination of everything that came before. Now, let's bring it specifically to Ana in Kurdish folk religion. What does she look like in that context? How does she actually manifest in the beliefs and practices of Kurdish people?
Indeed, that journey sets the stage perfectly for Ana. Within the, let's say, pre-modern Kurdish cosmological framework, Ana is fundamentally the goddess of water and rain. She's a powerful deity. Her primary role is ensuring the survival and prosperity of what they consider the holy creation. But her domains extend beyond just agricultural fertility. They include wisdom and healing, too. Mm-hmm. So she's really a multifaceted, benevolent protectress. And she's seen as particularly concerned with the well-being of women, promoting fertility, guaranteeing safe childbirth. Her very essence is embodied in the life-giving waters, the waters flowing from sacred mountain springs down to the rivers and lakes. She's a tangible manifestation of divine power right there in the natural world.
Not just a concept, but physically present in the water.
Oh, exactly. She's not distant. She's in every drop of life-giving water. And the linguistic connection to her Iranian predecessor is direct, unambiguous. The Kurdish name Ana is a direct correspondent to the Persian Anahid and the Avestan Anahita. This continuity in the name confirms her place within that broader Iranic language and cultural tradition. Plus, much like her Iranian precursor, Ana is often paired with the solar deity Mithra.
I'm Mithra again.
Yes. Together, they're believed to oversee the orderly change of the seasons. It's a cosmic partnership that places Ana right at the heart of cosmic order, governing the fundamental cycles of nature. This pairing highlights her role not just in life-giving, but in maintaining the very balance of the world. But perhaps the most remarkable, the most tangible persistence of Ana's authority is found in this socio-religious concept of Anaship.
Anaship. Tell me more about that.
Within the heterodox Kurdish faith of Rhea Heki, which is often associated with Alevism, there's a profound belief that women possess a degree of divine nature. Now, this belief stands in stark contrast to the patriarchal norms you often find in the surrounding Abrahamic religions. And this belief is institutionalized in the role of the Ana. That's a title for female saint or spiritual leader. Anaship isn't just an honorific title, it's a recognized, respected position of spiritual authority. And here's the significant part. In a real subversion of typical religious hierarchies, an Ana can even assume the duties and status of a peer that's a male saint or elder if he's absent.
Wow, a woman taking over the role of a male spiritual leader, that's huge.
It is huge. Imagine the impact of a woman stepping into that traditionally male role, guided by a belief that her very being reflects the divine feminine. This institution of Anaship, it represents far more than just some quaint folk survival. It is a living remnant of the goddess cult. It's a structured social and religious role that translates the mythological power of the divine feminine into tangible authority for actual human women. Its very existence shows how the prestige and power of the ancient mother goddesses weren't entirely relegated to myth. They were preserved in a functional capacity, creating a protected space for female spiritual leadership within the community. It really stands as a kind of socio-religious fossil of the pre-Islamic era. a direct, undeniable link between contemporary female leaders and the divine authority of the goddess Anna herself. It's a powerful demonstration of how ancient beliefs can keep shaping social structures, even today.
That's truly impactful. Annaship really shows how her power wasn't just abstract, but became a real, tangible part of social structure, influencing roles and respect within communities. This idea of Anna being woven into daily life.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of how certain traditions still punctuate her own day, like the arrival of our tea. Mm-hmm. Huh. Hannah the Chai Lady's here. Rosh Bash Hannah. Slight pause. Ah, brilliant. Thank you, Hannah. Slight pause. How's this chai today? Is it perfect, or maybe does it need a touch more sugar, you think?
Slight pause. Let me see. It's got a lovely warmth, definitely. A nice spice blend. But perhaps. Yeah, perhaps just a whisper more sweetness would balance out that slight bitterness. It's almost there. Really good, though.
Agreed. Let's get Hannah to work her magic. Thank you, Hannah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, refreshed and ready for more insights. We were just discussing how Anna's power became tangible in Annaship, influencing female leadership. Now let's explore further. How is her veneration expressed through actual rituals and practices in daily life? How did people interact with her on a regular, intimate basis?
Right. Her worship wasn't just about abstract belief. It was lived through this rich tapestry of communal rituals. These practices were deeply embedded in the rhythms of daily life. They translated faith into action, and they constantly reinforced the bond between the community, the land, and the goddess herself. These rituals consistently centered on key liminal moments, moments of transition in both the agricultural year and the human life cycle. And water was always the primary medium, the sacred medium. In her role as a divine guardian of these transitions, Anna was invoked to ensure safe passage, continued life, and prosperity. Let's look at the water and fertility rituals first. The most direct manifestation of Anna's cult is in ceremonies specifically designed to get rain and ensure the land's fertility. The rain bride ceremony, the Bukabaran, was a widespread practice during droughts. Villagers would make a doll, often from wood or cloth, to represent this rain bride. Then they'd parade this effigy through the village, door to door.
Like a procession.
Exactly, a procession, accompanied by traditional songs pleading for rain. A typical song might implore, "God let the rain fall for the sick and the poor." You can imagine the collective anxiety of a community facing drought and the hope, the unity in these processions. After the procession, the doll would be thrown into a nearby river or stream. It's a symbolic act, returning the effigy to the goddess's domain to activate her life-giving power to bring the rain. And this connection between Anna and water was also deeply personal, even mythic. In the Dersim region, northern Kurdistan, there's a strong belief that on the morning of Kili Hovin, that's the 40th day of summer, Anna herself would descend to bathe in a river.
The goddess herself.
Yes, specifically at a point where two streams met. A confluence, which symbolizes potent spiritual energy, the convergence of life forces. This belief connects Anna to vital resources, but also makes specific natural places profoundly sacred. Beyond these agricultural rituals, Anna's protection was seen as absolutely essential during those vulnerable transitional phases of human life, especially birth and marriage. The village, well, seen as a direct link to the subterranean waters of the goddess, often served as the main ritual site for these life cycle ceremonies. For newborns, for example, a 40-day-old infant would have a special washing ceremony. The water for this bath was sanctified by adding 40 seeds of wheat, a potent symbol of life, agricultural bounty. It placed the child under the goddess's protection right from the start.
40 days seems significant.
It does. It reappears often. For new mothers, too, there was a tradition of seclusion in her home for 40 days after birth, a time of recovery. Her re-entry into public life was marked by a formal ceremony. She'd be taken to the village well, ritually reintegrating her into the community under Anna's sacred gaze. And new brides as well. A new bride's first public appearance after her wedding was often a procession to the village well. This ritual introduced her to the spiritual heart of her new community and placed her marriage and future fertility under the goddess's blessing. These rituals really highlight a pervasive belief in Anna's active, protective role throughout a woman's life.
It's fascinating how tied it is to specific life events in places like the well. What about bigger seasonal festivals?
Yes, the agricultural calendar was also marked by important seasonal festivals honoring Anna's role in the cycle of growth and harvest. Chili Havenhoen, which we mentioned, the Midsummer Festival, 40th day of summer, it marked a crucial turning point. The intense heat starts to subside, the first fruits ripen. It was a time for communities to visit springs, rivers, lakes, offer thanks and prayers to the life-giving water. It was joyous, often filled with music, the daff, a frame drum, the tambour, a lute. They distribute the early harvest pomegranates, figs, grief sharing the bounty. And the most evocative tradition, again, was making dolls representing Anna. At the festival's end, these dolls were ceremonially thrown into a river.
Like the Rain Bride again.
Exactly, mirroring the Rain Bride, reinforcing that cyclical nature of giving back to the goddess to ensure future bounty. This idea of cyclical reciprocity with nature is really central. And Anna's influence even extended to rituals linked with the great Iranian New Year festival, Nowruz. There's a practice recorded among Kurds involving baking a special cake using wheat grown just for this ceremony. This cake would be left overnight in a room in the hope that Aisha or Fatima, Queen Anahita, would come and leave her handprint on it as a blessing for the coming year's harvest.
Wait, Aisha or Fatima and Queen Anahita in parentheses as part of the tradition itself.
Yes, that's the striking part. That parenthetical equation isn't a modern academic interpretation. It's recorded as part of the folk tradition itself. It shows a clear, conscious understanding among the people that the figure being venerated was, in essence, the ancient goddess, just operating under an Islamically acceptable name.
That's incredible syncretism right there in the ritual.
Absolutely. It's a classic example of old wine in new bottles. It allowed these essential beliefs and harvest rituals to continue. The pomegranate, Hanar, which is seen as a heavenly tree in Kurdish culture, was a key offering and symbol throughout these rituals, too. What a brilliant way to ensure ancient traditions could survive.
That paints such a vivid picture. It's clear Anna isn't just some figure in an old book. She's woven right into the fabric of daily life, from hoping for rain to the most intimate family moments, birth, marriage. And it's not just the rituals, but the land itself seems to bear her mark. So how is Anna's presence marked across the physical landscape of Kurdistan? Are there specific places tied to her veneration that act like natural shrines?
Absolutely. Her veneration wasn't just confined to rituals or festivals. Her presence was quite literally inscribed onto the geography of Kurdistan. Her cult sanctified the natural world. It transformed mountains, caves, springs, even unique geological features into living shrines. This sacred landscape effectively served as a permanent, decentralized temple, embedding her memory and power into the land itself. This tradition is part of a broader Kurdish worldview that sees nature as inherently sacred. And that perspective has been crucial in preserving these ancient beliefs through millennia of change. The land itself becomes a testament to her enduring spirit. We have archaeological evidence, too, attesting to formal temples dedicated to Anna, especially during the Parthian and Sasanian periods. One of the most significant sites is the Charstin Cave, meaning four pillars in Duhok province. The site is believed to have been a fire temple dedicated to the goddess.
A fire temple for a water goddess.
It might seem contradictory, but remember, in the Iranic worldview, fire and water were the two primary sacred elements. They were often linked to the divine pair Mithra, associated with fire sun, and Anahita, water. So it shows a complementary relationship. The discovery of her emblem, a fire altar right in the cave, plus an open-air sacrificial area, confirms it was a major cultic center. Another sanctuary, Rabana Merkli, has also been suggested by archaeologists as an Anahita site. So there was a formal cult presence. But beyond constructed temples, Anna's cult was powerfully connected to dramatic natural phenomena, like the eternal flames at Baba Gurgur near Kirkuk.
Eternal flames? How?
They're fed by natural gas and petroleum seeps from the ground. These self-sustaining fires would naturally attract Mithraic and Zoroastrian worship, and a shrine to Anna was established there too. It directly links her to this potent display of nature's power. Kurdish women would often visit Baba Gurgur to pray for fertility, invoking Anna's name, seeking blessings from that sacred fire. It's a striking image, isn't it? A goddess of water linked to eternal flames. Water sources, of course, were the most common and intimate of Anna's shrines. In Dersim, a region known for strong pre-Islamic survivals, there was a very revered spring of Anna. The water from this spring was reverently called mother's milk by the Rea Heki Kurds. That highlights its life-giving, nourishing quality. Its sanctity was so profound it was even used in reconciliation rituals. Warring parties would be brought there to drink from the spring as a binding oath to end their conflict. Imagine water bringing peace.
Wow, that gives it real social power, too.
Definitely. Similarly, in the Irsani faith, there's a holy fountain named Hanita, a direct linguistic variant of Anahita, believed to flow from the sacred Dalahu Mountains in eastern Kurdistan, reinforcing that continuity. Now, this specific veneration of Anna's sites, it fits within a wider, deeply ingrained Kurdish spiritual tradition of nature worship. This worldview is encapsulated in the Kurdish Alevi concept of Jiyar. A Jiyar, plural gerere, is a sacred place or object. It could be an ancient tree, a mountain peak, a distinctive rock, a cave, a river. It's considered a living, sentient entity, often embodying or connected to an ancestral or semi-deific spirit. This belief system transforms whole regions like Dersim into a Giar Udiar, a sacred land animated by non-human agencies existing in mythic time.
So the whole landscape is potentially sacred?
In a way, yes. Every natural feature can hold spiritual significance. A prime example is the Tree of Wishes, Dara Mirzan. Across Kurdistan, ancient, venerable trees were seen as sacred. People would visit them for healing or to ask for wishes, often tying a piece of cloth to a branch as a physical link to the tree's power. These trees were believed to be inhabited by guardian spirits called Do, associated with fertility, guidance, protection. Sacrifices were often made to them. This practice is documented by travelers for centuries, and this conception of an animated sacred landscape has profound implications. Think about historical pressures, state-sponsored orthodoxies, modern development trying to control or exploit the land. The Gier system functions as a powerful form of spiritual and cultural resistance. By embedding divinity within the land itself, the tradition creates a religious framework that's decentralized, incredibly resilient, and intrinsically tied to Kurdish identity and memory. The land essentially becomes a living archive, an active participant in spiritual life. Its sacredness is hard to erase. So venerating Anna Springs or sacred groves isn't just nature worship. It's an act of placemaking. It defines the homeland as sacred, preserving an ancient worldview against external pressures. The very ground underfoot tells a story of ancient belief.
What an extraordinary journey through millennia of belief and cultural resilience. We've truly seen how the figure of the Mother Goddess in her many forms has been this continuous thread in the fabric of the Near East, culminating in the powerful, adaptable figure of Inanna in Kurdish culture. It's truly remarkable how her veneration is not just ancient, but seems alive in so many forms and places. How did this survival happen, especially with so much religious and political upheaval over millennia? How did she endure?
Her persistence is really a testament to the resilience of these ancient Near Eastern spiritual ideas. And it's emblematic of the broader endurance of pre-Islamic beliefs within the unique cultural and religious landscape of Kurdistan. Her survival was achieved mainly through two mechanisms, two ingenious forms of adaptation, really. First, the terrain itself. The mountainous, often inaccessible terrain of Kurdistan historically acted as a sanctuary. It sheltered traditions that were suppressed or eliminated elsewhere in the more centralized plains. Before Islam arrived, the dominant faiths among many Kurds were Iranic religions, primarily Mithraism and related belief systems. Scholars sometimes group these as Yazdanism, the cult of angels. While Zoroastrianism was the official Sasanian state religion, many Kurdish tribes, especially in isolated mountain areas, held on to these older Mithra-centric beliefs. These ancient faiths didn't just vanish when Islam arrived. They found refuge, continued expression, in the heterodox communities. The Yazidis, the Yarsanis, also known as Ali Haq, and the Alevi Kurds.
So these groups acted like protectors of the older ways.
You could say they acted as cultural and theological arcs. They preserved core elements of pre-Islamic cosmology, like the belief in a heptad, seven divine beings or angels who govern the world. That's fundamental to their spiritual order. A really compelling case study of this preservation is in the Yazidi faith. Specifically, the female divine being, or Shudan, known as Pirafut. If you look closely, she appears to be a near-perfect continuation of the Iranian goddess Anahita.
Really? How so?
Their functions are remarkably similar. Pirafut's main role in Yazidi cosmology is the preserver of the first seed. This directly mirrors how the Avestan texts describe Anahita, she who makes the seed of all males pure and makes the womb of all females pure. Both goddesses are fundamentally responsible for the sanctity, the success of procreation, ensuring life continues. And this concept isn't just some random similarity. It's an authentic Iranian mythology, a core theme running through Iranian mythology. Pirafut's role directly parallels the myth of Spendarmeh, the personification of earth, in the Zoroastrian creation story, the Bundahish. In that myth, when the first man, Geshmart, dies, his seed falls to earth and Spendarmeh preserves it for 40 years, eventually giving rise to the first human couple. The preservation of primordial seed is a recurring motif. It confirms the authentic lineage of Pirafut within Yazidi belief.
That's a strong link.
It is. And what's more, the Yazidi pantheon elaborates on this theme with a second female figure, Shatuna Farksan. Her name translates as the Dame of Children. While Pirafut oversees the whole procreative process, conception, labor, postnatal period, Shatuna Farksan's role is more specifically focused on protecting women during pregnancy. This division of labor between two distinct female deities, it's a sophisticated theological development. It suggests that as the ancient, multifaceted Anahita was integrated into the Yazidi system, her various functions were sort of partitioned, assigned to specialized figures.
So they didn't dilute her power, they specialized it.
Exactly. It wasn't dilution, it was a meticulous method of preservation. By creating these distinct but complementary roles, the Yazidi faith ensured all of the essential attributes of the ancient mother goddess were carefully maintained, curated within their new framework. So these heterodox faiths aren't just passive survivals, they were active, conscious curators of a pre-Islamic religious heritage. What a powerful testament to deliberately preserving spiritual identity.
That's a powerful explanation for how these beliefs were kept alive in those specific, often isolated communities. But what about the majority of Kurds who eventually converted to Islam? How did Anna's presence persist there without being explicitly worshipped or, you know, contradicting Islamic monotheism?
Right, that brings us to the second primary mechanism, syncretism and transformation. The eventual conversion of most Kurds to Islam, a process starting in the 7th century, often complex, sometimes violent, certainly posed a direct threat to openly venerating pre-Islamic deities. But the deeply rooted cult of the mother goddess wasn't simply eradicated. Instead, it underwent this profound transformation through religious syncretism, the blending or fusion of beliefs. This allowed ancient rituals and the veneration of the divine feminine to continue by basically grafting Anna's attributes onto revered female figures within Islam, most notably Fatima, the Prophet Muhammad's daughter, but also Mother Aisha.
So they sort of mapped Anna onto figures like Fatima.
Exactly. This Islamicization of the goddess was a strategic act of cultural preservation. It created an acceptable public face for ancient beliefs. Anna's core functions, protectress of women, guarantor of fertility, were seamlessly transferred to these Islamic saints. The sources explicitly note that after Islam spread, beliefs about the mother goddess were transformed into the cults of Mother Aisha and Mother Fatima, whose images as patronesses of women became extremely popular. It wasn't just replacement, it was reinterpretation. And the most telling evidence of this conscious syncretism comes right from ritual practice. That ceremony we talked about after Newroz with the special cake left overnight.
The one hoping for the handprint.
Yes. Hoping for the touch of Aisha or Fatima, Queen Anahita. The truly remarkable thing, again, is that parenthetical equation, Queen Anahita, isn't some modern interpretation. It's recorded as part of the folk tradition itself. It shows a clear, conscious understanding among the people that the figure being venerated was, in essence, the ancient goddess, just operating under an Islamically sanctioned name.
That's just fascinating. They knew who they were really honoring.
It seems so. It's a classic example of old wine being poured into new bottles. A mechanism allowing essential beliefs and, crucially, the associated rituals for ensuring a good harvest and community well-being to continue uninterrupted, just in a modified form. Now, this syncretism wasn't always total. It didn't erase all memory of the original deity. In some areas, her original name persisted alongside the Islamic figures. For instance, even Muslim Kurds are known to have maintained a shrine dedicated to Anna the Pure, meaning Anna the Elder. It shows the memory wasn't entirely effaced, even within a monotheistic framework. This blending of traditions allowed the fundamental archetype of the mother goddess to survive. She proved powerful enough to endure by adopting a new mask when her old one became religiously or politically difficult. It's a real testament to the profound, lasting hold she had on the Kurdish spiritual imagination and cultural fabric. It's a powerful example of how culture finds ways to preserve its core beliefs, even under immense pressure.
So Anna persisted through both these hidden arc religions and this clever syncretism within Islam. An incredible demonstration of cultural resilience. But I understand there's another powerful female figure in Kurdish folklore, one who offers maybe a different, perhaps darker, or at least more enigmatic side of feminine power. Who is Shamran, and how does she fit into this broader cosmology of the divine feminine in Kurdistan?
That's an excellent question, and she's essential for a complete picture. While Anna represents the celestial, life-giving, Uranian aspect of feminine power, the bright, visible source of life from water and rain, tied to communal blessings, Shamran embodies the complementary chthonic aspect.
Chthonic.
Earthly, subterranean. The hidden dimensions of feminine power. Her myth explores things like secret wisdom, the duality of nature, sacrifice, and the often tragic consequences of betraying ancient, sacred knowledge. She's the hidden power, the whispered truth. Shamran, her name comes from Persian. Shamran, literally queen of snakes. She's a mythical being, half woman, half snake.
Half woman, half half snake. Okay.
And she rules over this hidden underground kingdom of serpents, a realm of esoteric wisdom concealed from the human world. Imagine a shimmering hidden domain filled with ancient knowledge. The core narrative, though details vary by region, always tells of a young man, sometimes Tamasp, sometimes Gemasp or Kamasp, who accidentally discovers her realm, usually after being abandoned in a cave or falling into a well. Instead of harming him, Shamaran welcomes him. She shares her profound knowledge of the world with him, and in many versions, they become lovers. He lives there for years, absorbing secrets. Eventually, though, he longs to return to his own world, the surface. Shamaran reluctantly agrees, but makes him promise never to reveal her existence, and she warns him. His body now carries a sign, scales that will appear if he ever bathes with other men, a constant reminder of his oath.
Ah, the fatal flaw is set up.
Exactly. Years later, the mortal king falls gravely ill. His advisors declare the only cure is to eat Shamaran's flesh. To find her, the king's men force all men into the public baths, looking for someone with scales. Tamasp is discovered and, under duress, tragically betrays his promise. Shamaran is captured. And in a final act of wisdom and profound sacrifice, she instructs her captors how to prepare her body. She says her flesh will heal the king, but the water from her first boiling, or sometimes it's her poisonous tail, will kill the greedy vizier. However, the water from the second boiling, or sometimes her head, will grant her own esoteric wisdom to whoever drinks it. And that turns out to be Tamasp himself.
So the betrayer gets the wisdom.
Yes. The prophecy is fulfilled. The greedy die, the king is healed, and the betrayer, Tamasp, is cursed to wander the earth, burdened by her wisdom, living with the consequences of his betrayal. His knowledge comes at a terrible price. Shamaran is a really complex symbol. Wisdom, protection, abundance, resilience. The serpent itself is almost universal, isn't it? A symbol of earth, underworld, fertility, the cycles of life, death, rebirth, shedding its skin. Her connection to fertility is seen in the tradition of young brides, including an image of Shamaran in their dowry, hoping for a happy, fruitful marriage. There are rituals, too, like preparing a ceremonial porridge, Dakulani Shamaran, distributed for blessing and protection, especially against snake bites. So if you view Anna and Shamaran together, they can be understood as two halves of a complete cosmology of the divine feminine in Kurdish tradition. Anna, celestial waters, mountains, bright, public, life-sustaining, communal rituals, visible cycles, open blessings. Shamaran, underground kingdom, dark, secret, initiatory. Esoteric wisdom, hidden realm, tragic story of sacrifice, power transfer through death and knowledge.
So the life giver and the keeper of hidden wisdom.
Precisely. Together, they encompass the full spectrum. The benevolent, life-giving mother and the wise shamanic crone, holding secrets of the earth and the unseen. The Shamaran myth can also be read as a powerful allegory, maybe for the suppression of ancient, earth-based female wisdom by a patriarchal order, the mortal king that consumes her power for its own survival, but ultimately destroys the source. It's a profound narrative about the cost of power and the enduring, if sometimes hidden, nature of wisdom.
What an extraordinary exploration through millennia of belief and cultural resilience. Mm. We've really seen how the figure of the mother goddess in her many forms, like Anna, has been this continuous thread in the fabric of the Near East, culminating in these powerful, adaptable figures within Kurdish culture. It's striking to me how this thread has persisted through so much change. So reflecting on all this, what does it mean for us, for you listening? What's the core takeaway from this exploration of Anna's enduring legacy?
Well, I think the enduring legacy of the mother goddess in Kurdistan, seen through both Anna and Shamaran, it really highlights this profound, unyielding connection, a connection between a people, their land, and a worldview that sees divinity embedded right there in nature itself. It's a powerful reminder that spiritual traditions aren't static things preserved in amber. They evolve, they adapt. And sometimes they endure precisely by becoming something new while still retaining their ancient heart. This incredible persistence, even under intense pressure from empires, changing religions. It demonstrates a profound human need, perhaps, for connection to the divine feminine and to the earth. It's a story of survival, transformation, and deep cultural memory. And this, I think, raises an important question for you, the listener, to maybe ponder. In our world today, where information spreads instantly and cultures often seem to homogenize, what ancient, deeply rooted traditions might still be subtly shaping the societies around us, perhaps even in plain sight, without us consciously realizing it? What hidden streams of belief are still flowing beneath the surface of modernity, influencing our behavior, our customs, maybe even our relationship with the natural world, just waiting to be rediscovered?